Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
It's Monday, September 21st, 2015. Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English branch in Washington. Today on the program, we report on the planned visit to the United States this week by Pope Francis, the leader of the Roman Catholic Church. Francis is often called the first American pope because he was born and raised in the Americas, Argentina to be exact. No pope before him had come from the New World. But Francis has never traveled to this America, the United States of America. That changes this week.
He is coming as a spiritual leader, as a shepherd of souls, not to talk politics, not to talk public policy.
Then, as always on Mondays, you will hear Jonathan Evans' technology report. This week, he tells us about a new device that scientists have developed that will quickly collect information about buildings that once took weeks to measure and process.
You can create a 3D model, which can show an IR image of the walls and look at the thermal capacity of the building.
And as always, we will present the making of a nation. Every day here at VOA Learning English, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Francis will soon be in the United States for the first time in his life. The popular leader of the Roman Catholic Church is often called the first American pope because no other pope before him came from the Americas. Francis was born and raised in South America, but he has not yet been to the United States of America. Large numbers of people are expected to come to see the Pope in the three cities he will visit, Washington, D.C., New York, and Philadelphia. Crowds in Washington are expected to be so large that federal government workers have been encouraged to work from home when Francis is in the nation's capital. Ann Ball tells us more now about the visit.
Pope Francis is known to speak publicly about many controversial issues. But in an interview with VOA, the Archbishop of Washington says the Pope probably will not discuss politics while he is here. Cardinal Donald Wuerl calls the trip a pastoral visit.
He is coming as a spiritual leader, as a shepherd of souls. And so I think whatever we hear from him has to be heard and seen through that lens, that he has come not to talk politics, not to talk public policy, but to talk about the values that come out of the gospel message.
Thousands of people are expected on the South Lawn of the White House for the Pope's arrival on September 23rd. They will help President Barack Obama greet Francis. The White House invited a cross-section of people representing American religious life to attend. They include leaders of Christian evangelical groups, a gay Catholic blogger, and a Roman Catholic nun who leads bus tours for social justice. Francis and Mr. Obama will talk privately after the South Lawn reception. A White House spokesperson says the president hopes to discuss the environment, immigrants and refugees, and religious freedom. Pope Francis has addressed these topics before. Last May, Francis's encyclical on climate change called for wealthy nations to overcome global warming, and he has drawn attention to the plight of migrants. As with other trips he has taken, the Pope will move between the powerful and the poor. After his speech to Congress, the first by any pontiff, the Pope will visit a homeless shelter. Also, while in Washington, he will say an outdoor mass in Spanish, and he will canonize the 18th century Spanish missionary Junipero Serra, who founded a series of missions in California. In Philadelphia, Pope Francis will speak at Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence was approved. Then he will visit a prison. And in New York City, Pope Francis will address the United Nations General Assembly and visit the September 11th memorial. Cardinal Wuerl says the Pope will talk about building a good and just society.
I would expect that we're going to hear from him a call to work together to address the needs of our brothers and sisters, especially the less fortunate.
Everywhere the Pope goes, people are expected to line the roads, hoping to see him. Social media platforms are getting ready for a large increase in activity. Wireless carriers are bringing in portable cell towers. In Philadelphia, antennas are being added to streetlights. A closing mass there is expected to draw more than 1 million people. Pope Francis's rock star image is confirmed by Twitter. His accounts are in 9 languages, including Arabic. And now he has 22.7 million followers. That is more than singers Miley Cyrus or Nicki Minaj have. Many of his followers are talking about the Pope's recent statements. He says women can be forgiven if they have an abortion. He also wants to speed up the annulment process, so people who want to end a marriage might be able to do so and remarry in the church. Austin Ivory wrote a biography of Francis called The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. He calls Francis a change agent, but the author says the Pope is not trying to change fundamental church teachings.
What I keep saying is, look, he's a faithful son of the church. He is not about changing church doctrines or teachings. He's a very strong defender of core Catholic teaching.
Mr. Ivory says the Pope wants to put the loving mercy of God front and center. In the United States, attendance in Catholic churches has been declining. The Pew Research Center estimates that 4 out of 10 American adults who were born Catholic no longer identify themselves as Catholic. The U.S. Roman Catholic Church is also still suffering from the wounds of a sex scandal. At least 300 members of the Catholic clergy have been convicted of sexual assault, according to Bishop Accountability, a private group that watches the scandal. Settlement payments to victims and other costs have totaled around $3 billion. The church has been accused of trying to protect priests who committed these crimes. I'm Ann Ball.
Now it's time for our weekly look at the latest technology news. Architects, engineers, and building supervisors will soon be able to quickly collect information that once took weeks to measure and process. Scientists have developed a device to gather information about building interiors, the design and exact measurements of a building. Their invention connects to a small container that can be carried on a person's back. Our technology correspondent Jonathan Evans tells us more.
The device requires only one pass through a building to create a three-dimensional or 3D model of the structure. In other words, the model shows an object's height, width, and depth. The device also is able to collect other valuable information related to the building's energy usage. An older building may need a new, more efficient heating and cooling system. Experts say the first thing you need to know is the exact shape of all rooms in the building. You have to consider the size and position of heating and cooling equipment, windows, and doors. Another consideration is the placement of electrical outlets, the areas where electrically operated equipment can be connected to the power supply. Annie Marston is with Bauman Consulting, the business that developed the new device. She says that instead of using a team of experts with laptop computers and other devices, it will soon be possible to send only one person with a space-age backpack.
The backpack is something you can wear which has a lot of sensors on the back, which can then walk through a building and detect the geometry, the lights, the plug load. And once you take it out, you can create a 3D model, which can show an IR image of the walls and look at the thermal capacity of the building. And then it can be transferred into an energy model, and that energy model can be run and look at how the energy is dispersed within the building, and that's where we can start looking at saving measures and things like that.
Weather experts use a scientific instrument called a barometer to measure pressure in Earth's atmosphere. But the device uses a barometer to estimate height. Instruments called magnetometers act as 3D compasses. They gather information about metallic structures. The University of California scientists say they can create a virtual map with an accuracy of plus or minus 10 centimeters. They say the device uses a mathematical problem to add surfaces to the walls and floors. This can be used for architectural design or to run tests on energy usage. Annie Marston says the device may be very useful to energy testers and engineers, but also to builders and the construction industry. When they are building a new construction, it will be great to have a model of the ducts and the pipes before the walls are closed up, so in later years, you know where everything is, she says. Researchers say they are now working to lower the weight of the backpack from 15 to about 10 kilograms. But the price of the device is about $20,000. Researchers predict the device will be available for loan at a much lower price. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. That's our program for today. The Making of a Nation is coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz at the Voice of America in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The Missouri Compromise in 1820 said that Missouri could enter the Union as a slave state, and Maine could enter as a free state. By approving these two states at the same time, Congress kept a balance of power in the Senate between slave and free states. But the compromise also said no more states in the Northern Louisiana Territory could be admitted as slave states. As a result, slavery could not enter the new areas of the United States. Some people did not like the compromise. They said it limited the ability of slave owners to settle in the country's western territory. Others said the Constitution did not permit Congress to say that new states had to be slave or free. Even President Monroe did not believe the government had the power to make such decisions. Yet he approved the compromise. He was trying, he said, to avoid a civil war. Monroe's decision to approve the compromise did not hurt his election chances in 1820. There was, at this time, really only one party, the Republican Party, and he was its leader. The opposition Federalist Party was dead. It was no longer an election threat. So Monroe was the only presidential candidate in the election of 1820. He received the vote of every elector except for one. William Plummer of New Hampshire voted for John Quincy Adams. He explained later that George Washington had been the only president to get all the electoral votes. Plummer said he did not want anyone to share this honor given to Washington. Monroe's first 4 years as president had been successful. He had increased the size of the United States. Florida was now part of the country, and the problem of slavery had been temporarily settled. There had been economic problems, some of the worst in the nation's history, but the situation was getting better. And the nation was growing. As it grew, new problems developed between its different sections. There were really three separate areas with very different interests. The northeastern states had become the industrial center of the nation. The southern states were agricultural, with large farms that produced cotton, rice, and tobacco. Much of the work on these farms was done by slave labor. The western states were areas of small farms where grain was produced with free labor. It was a place where the land did not cost much and where people could make a new start and build a new life. This division of the nation into different sections with opposing interests ended the one-party system of Monroe's administration. The industrial Northeast wanted high taxes on imported products to protect its industry from foreign competition. This part of the country also believed the national government should pay for roads and waterways to get their products to markets. The South did not agree to high import taxes. These taxes raised the prices on all goods,
and import taxes on foreign goods might cause foreign nations to raise import taxes on Southern cotton and tobacco. The South also opposed spending federal money for roads and canals. The mountains through parts of the southern Atlantic states would make road building difficult and canals impossible. The western states supported government aid in building roads and canals. The Ohio and Mississippi rivers were the only inexpensive transportation systems for moving their products to markets. The Westerners also supported high taxes on imports because they believed such taxes would raise the prices of their agricultural products. The separate interests of these different sections produced an exciting campaign in the next presidential election. Each section had at least one candidate. Several had more than one. The campaign began almost as soon as Monroe was elected for the second time. At one time, as many as 16 men thought of themselves as presidential possibilities. By 1822, the number had been reduced to 6 men. John Quincy Adams was the only Northern candidate. He was an extremely able man. He was at the time Secretary of State, and there were few jobs in government he could not do and do well. But many people found him cold and questioning. His father was John Adams, the second President of the United States. The West had two candidates. One was Henry Clay of Kentucky, popularly known as Harry of the West. He was a great lawyer, congressman, Speaker of the House, and senator. The other was Andrew Jackson, known as Old Hickory, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812. Jackson knew little about government. He was a fighter, a man of the people. In the election of 1824, Jackson got the most electoral votes, 99. But he needed 130 to win a majority. The Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, was second. Treasury Secretary William Crawford was third, and Henry Clay of Kentucky was fourth. Because none of the candidates got a majority of the votes, the decision went to the House of Representatives. The House voted on only the three top candidates for president. The most powerful man in Congress, Henry Clay, was not, therefore, a candidate. But Clay's support would be the greatest help any of the candidates could receive. All three wanted his support. Treasury Secretary Crawford had suffered a serious illness before the election, and his health was bad. Clay felt he could not support him for that reason. This left Adams and Jackson. Clay did not agree with all of Adams' policies, but he did believe Adams had the education and ability to be president. Clay did not like Jackson, the hero of New Orleans. He knew Jackson was poorly educated and easy to anger. Clay did not think Jackson would be a good president. So Clay decided to support Adams for president. He said nothing about this for a time. Several of Clay's friends visited Adams. They told him that Clay's supporters in the West would be pleased if Adams, as president, named Clay
as Secretary of State. Adams told them that if the votes of the West elected him president, he would put a Westerner in his cabinet. But he would not promise that the Westerner would be Clay or that the cabinet job would be Secretary of State. Clay had still not said publicly which candidate he supported. But late in January, a Philadelphia newspaper published an unsigned letter. The letter charged that Clay and Adams had made a secret agreement. Clay, the letter said, would give his support to Adams. In exchange, Adams would name Clay as his Secretary of State. Clay was furious. He not only denied the charge, but offered to fight a duel with the letter writer. But whoever wrote the letter to the newspaper refused to say anything. Clay was sure Jackson's supporters were responsible. Snow was falling in Washington on the morning of February 9th, the day that Congress would elect the president. At noon, members of Congress walked into the House of Representatives. Each state had one vote for president. Adams was sure he would get the votes of 12 states. Crawford had the votes of 4, and Jackson, 7. New York was the question. 17 of the New York congressmen were for Adams, and 17 were against him. Adams needed just one of these votes to get the vote of New York and become president. One of those New Yorkers opposed to Adams was a rich old man who represented the Albany area, Stephen Van Rensselaer. Although Van Rensselaer had supported Crawford or Jackson, he really was not sure now whom to support. When the New York congressman voted, Van Rensselaer was still not certain. He put his head down on his desk and asked God to help him make the right choice. After this short prayer, he opened his eyes and saw on the floor at his feet a piece of paper with Adams' name on it. Van Rensselaer picked it up and put it in the ballot box as his vote. This gave Adams the vote of the state of New York and made him the next president of the United States. 2 days later, Adams told President Monroe that he had decided to offer the job of Secretary of State to Clay. He said he was doing so because of the Western support he had received. Clay accepted the offer. Now Jackson was sure that Clay had sold his vote to Adams for the top cabinet job. He wrote to a friend, "Was there ever before such barefaced corruption? What is this trade of vote for office, if not bribery?" Jackson, himself a senator, showed his feelings when the Senate was asked to approve Clay as Secretary of State. He voted no, and 13 other senators joined him against the nomination. But they were too few to prevent Clay from getting the job. With Clay as his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams began his first term as president. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.